Listen, did you know that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat? Yeah, disgusting, right? It can lead to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. It's just really gross. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth. They require up to 3 times less laundry, too, which who doesn't want less laundry? Miracle Made sheets have incredible self-cooling properties for better quality sleep. Their silver-infused fabrics are inspired by NASA, and they are thermoregulating. That means they are specifically designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. Say goodbye to gross odors with the sheets' self-cleaning properties. And I also have to say, they're super duper comfortable and they don't have the high price tag of some of the other brands. Also, it's allergy season, y'all. So I don't know if you're like me, but I'm looking for a springtime refresh in my house, and I think you deserve one too. So go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you are not 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we welcome Joseph Earl Thomas to the show. Joseph is a writer and doctoral candidate in English at the University of Pennsylvania with an MFA in English from Notre Dame. Today, we're discussing his debut book, a memoir called Sink, about his childhood in Philadelphia. We talk about why embracing and sharing trauma feels like an act of defiance for Black writers right now, what it means to have no adult role models, and some of the formal choices Joseph made in the telling of his story. Our March book club pick is the essay collection Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay. Shanita Hubbard will join us on March 29th for our book club discussion. Quick reminder, everything we talk about in each episode can be found in the link in the show notes. If you love The Stacks and you want more of it, things like our incredible Discord community, our monthly bonus episodes, our virtual meetups to discuss our book club picks, you must join The Stacks Pack on Patreon. It's just $5 a month and you get all of the things I just mentioned, plus a lot more, and you get to know that you're part of making this Black woman-run independent podcast a reality every single week. Head to patreon.com/thestacks and join now. I want to give a special shout out to some of our newest members of the Stacks Pack, Loretta Arvizu, Eric Pelissari, Angela Forrestal, Laurel Hamming, Kelly, and Anne McDonnell. Thank you all so much, and thank you to the entire Stacks Pack. All right, now it's time for my conversation with Joseph Earl Thomas. All right, everybody. I'm super excited today. I'm joined by Joseph Earl Thomas, whose brand new debut memoir is called Sink. It's out now. Joseph, welcome to The Stacks.
Hey, welcome, Tracy. Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to talk to you about your book. But before I start asking my questions, I'm going to ask you to tell folks in about 30 seconds or so what Sink is about.
Yeah, I see Sink being primarily about extending conversations that have to do with Black childhood specifically and interiority, and staying with that rather than like moving on to an adult kind of self at the end of the book and thinking of coming of age terms.
Yeah, it's definitely focused on your childhood, and it is pretty brutal. I mean, times were tough. Like I had a difficult time reading the book because I was like, Can he become an adult so that I can move on? Like, I was like, I need to know that he's okay, which is probably why you wanted to stay in the child space. Will you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, there's like a trope that goes around, right? And I was talking to a bunch of friends about the book, about like, oh, yeah, you know, what age did you think you would live to? You know, there's like the kind of joke that a lot of folks will say, like, you know, not living past 25, especially if you're like a Black person in a certain setting. And it was really important to me to kind of think about that space as being important in and of itself, with the fact that like a lot of people that I know who would have been around, especially like did not grow to become adults, or like that is not, you know, a reality for a lot of folks that I still know. And even when I go back to my old neighborhood, I think about this, and this was a conversation that I was recently having with a friend. It's like, oh yeah, you know, so-and-so like, you know, didn't make it. Like this, like half of the people that we knew, actually, that was their entire life, like beginning to end. And I think I was at a point when I was younger, and a lot of my friends were at a point when we were all younger, where everybody thought that like that would be the terminus, right? Like it would not go past a certain extent. And I kind of wanted to take that seriously, right, in a way. Yeah.
Yeah. But let me ask you then about the adults in your life when you were a kid, because they did make it, right? Yeah. And like, what does it mean to make it? I don't know. I don't even know what the question is, but just hearing you talk about like kids feeling like as a child thinking that like there was a possibility that you wouldn't make it, that you would die, yeah, or that something bad would happen to you and you would cease to exist in some way. And then thinking about the fact that when you are a child, you're surrounded by adults who have made it, at least in the sense that they are alive. But like in your case, you know, your grandfather figure was sort of a monster to you. Like, so what does it mean to make it when that sometimes that alternative looks really horrible?
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, I mean, I maintain really close relationships with everyone in my family, right? So, like, for example, my grandfather, actually, he just died a couple weeks ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Around that time. And, you know, we talked all through my adult life and everything like that. And it's funny because as a child, I think it's like, I want to be clear about this. The way that things feel really fucked up sometimes, even if, you know, like somebody can, right, can yell at you or something, and to them it can be like no big deal, but to you as a kid sometimes you're like, oh my God, this person's gonna fucking kill me or something, right?
Right.
And
right.
You know, I tried to stay with that, and so that was part of trying to extend or be kind of intense about the relationships between adult and child. And then I always was very frustrated because I never knew any adults who had a kind of life that seemed worth living or that they seemed happy about having. And that was really fresh. So it was like my grandmother, she was murdered maybe about a couple years ago now.
Oh man.
But also lived the kind of life where we never saw her happy. We never saw my grandfather happy. My father was always in prison. You know, half of family was always in prison. So it wasn't like, it wasn't until I became an adult, right, where I met people who like, oh yeah, I went to this school and did this thing, right? But those people were nowhere present in my actual life. And so there was like this really claustrophobic feeling that you're supposed to be ashamed of course. Like I come to realize this later that right, you're supposed to be ashamed of and not be honest about that kind of feeling or experience. But I guess what I would say is that, you know, and my sister is probably my primary interlocutor with these kind of conversations, who was just walking out of my house with her kids and everything, because I was like, I'm going to talk right now. You know, we'd be like, yeah, who was an example of an adult that we knew that you would want to grow into? And there was no one. There wasn't anyone. And so it felt like, okay, either you can make this somehow good or better, or then you have to grow up and like deal with this other kind of thing that you don't want either.
Do you remember the first time you did encounter an adult? Like how old you were, that you wanted to grow into, like how old you were or what that looked like?
Yeah, I was in college.
So you were an adult.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I was an adult. A very awkward adult who was like, I can do stuff now and I'm figuring these things out. And I went to a community college and I met folks there. And I started meeting folks where I was like, oh, okay, this is an idea. And I joined the military when I was like 19. So a lot of that kind of stuff started to change. And, you know, you get out of, you know, Philadelphia, like in a particular neighborhood or space. And then you meet people who, you know, these things are normal for. They were like, you can go to grad school and people will pay you for that. I was like, that's a fucking lie. I don't believe that's true. And I was like, oh, that is true. This is like a possibility. And so things start to change around that time.
Interesting. So the framework of the book is, it's a memoir, but it's written like a novel. You're in third person. You're talking about Joey, which is, I'm assuming, what you were called as a child.
Yeah.
Why did you want to write it like that? What did that unlock for you? How did that help you or not, I guess, to tell your story? Why was that? I've never read a memoir like this. So I'm wondering, you know, how much of that decision, like how you came to that decision.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think the idea behind memoir, a lot of them, it's like there's a essayistic part of it where you get like exposition that explains the scenes mm-hmm. that you have, mm-hmm. You know, with like rough narrative. And I didn't want to do a lot of exposition. And I wanted to stay as tight as I could to like a childhood version of myself, even if I hated that version of myself sometimes. Right. And I didn't want to try and explain things that I would not have had no capacity to know at that time. So it was really important for me to stay in a kind of not just unknowing or not knowing things, but like not knowing what I didn't know kind of moments, which had to do with like where education was coming from, et cetera. And one of the ways that I had found to do that was to say, to kind of position myself as purely character and then build the kind of world around those scenes or situations without going into like an eye that was giving myself maybe a certain kind of comfort, but that wouldn't feel real to the circumstances themselves, I guess.
Right. A few weeks ago on the show, we had Kimon Felix, who wrote a memoir. And one of the things that I asked her was, you know, what does she hope that folks will keep in mind when she finishes or when they read the book? And she said something, and this, I talked to her like the day I started your book. So it was really in my mind as I was reading your book. But what she said was that she hoped that people wouldn't think of her as a person so that they could grapple with what was actually happening in the story instead of like feeling sympathy for her or feeling annoyed by her or whatever. And so I'm wondering if maybe any of that was in this for you, where there's a separation between Joey and Joseph for the reader, because I kept finding myself being like, this is a memoir. Stop. Like doing character analysis, like this is a person. So I'm wondering if that was present for you at all.
Yeah, I really love that. I mean, I love that episode too. And I agree with that. I think that that's a really good way to look at it. And it also brings, you know, it opens up the space of being like, all right, I want to ask more questions or present more sets of questions that I want to like provide answers or what have you, right? Which I think tends to happen when you get more kind of essayistic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so this is just such a small thing, but the start of your book, I knew that I loved you from the start of your book, because on the first page in the first sentence, we talk about easy bake ovens. And so for me personally, I just felt like you really brought me in, because that is very much specifically my entire personality at a young age. So I just want people to know, while the book is very brutal in some parts, there is some serious easy bake oven loving happening, and it is a joy. Not a question, just a statement.
I used to love those things. They were so important.
I know. And then towards the end of the book, you're like, it was just a microwave. And I was like, did he have to do that to me? I didn't need to be brutalized as well.
Well, that's the weird thing too, isn't it, Tracy? I feel like, you know, when you're a kid and you get this thing in your life that you don't have any other way of explaining, and someone tells you like, oh, this is like an oven, you're like, oh, this is amazing, right? But then you do get to a point where you get disenchanted by a whole host of items or whatever. But it was really fun for a long time, you know?
And it was so fun. Matters. It was so fun. It was like, I mean, I love to bake still. And while I don't attribute that necessarily to my love of my easy bake oven as a child, I still think fondly on that in the sense of like, perhaps it all sprung from my love of my pink and purple easy bake with like the special claw that would like pull out the circular trays and all of that. Like, it's like, oh, I'm just going to put this in the oven. Like, I'm a grown woman baking a circular cake cookie.
The little brownie.
Yeah, the brownie. And then you have to get like the special ingredient package. I bet now on TikTok they're like, here's how to make the like, copycat easy bake oven.
I'm afraid to look. I don't even want to know. Yeah.
I want to live happily in my nostalgia. Thank you very much. Okay. I want to go back to the book, even though that is in the book, but more seriously to the book. So how did you approach writing about like some of the abuse and things that you experienced? Like, how did you know how much to share? How did you think about your audience taking it in? How did you think about your own mental health? Like, how are you navigating writing some of this stuff? Because there's a lot of humor in the book, which I really appreciate and like, because that feels super holistic to an experience, especially as a child. But I also, there were moments in the book where I was like, I don't want to do this. Like, I don't want to know what happens because it's so hard. And obviously I pushed through, but I'm just wondering how you were thinking about it as the storyteller and also the person who lived it.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that all the way up until the very end, I went back and forth on because, I mean, so of course, the standard thing when you write a memoir is to, you know, ask people to read parts or, you know, what degree people are comfortable being in it. And I didn't keep anything in that people were like, that's not true, or I don't feel comfortable to this degree about it. And so a lot of it was like having conversations with people, whether that was like my aunt or my sister or my grandfather or my mom or someone, which actually kind of brought me closer to people, because a lot of folks were like, oh, I remember that. Like, I didn't mean that way. Or people were like, oh, I remember that now that you bring it up, you know?
Right,
or they'd be like, this was the name of that person or that scene, or it was on this day or whatever. So some of it was that. And there were some things where people were like, okay, I don't want that in there. And I was like, okay, that's fine. I won't put that. And then there was, you know, the other part of it where I had friends and family being like, you are going too easy on this person or this situation, and you need to be more like, this is, you know, fucked up, this is what happened. And I was kind of like, yeah, but like, it's not really about that, right? Like, it's not, you know, it's not like a hit piece kind of thing. It's about the feeling of being in a set of experiences. So I guess one way of answering it is I went back and forth on what was appropriate based on what people felt comfortable with. And if there were things that people wouldn't talk about at all, I tended not to put it in there. Which meant to me, like, if this thing is going to be out in the world and it is like about myself and people who I love and still speak to on a regular basis, if there's something that they would never speak about, I was like, okay, well then I'm not going to include that. And that helped kind of decide.
Right. And how did you think about your audience? Like the strangers who are going to read it?
It's complicated, Tracy, because, I mean, you know, there's this way that, like, you're not supposed to say bad things at all if you come from a certain set of people. Yeah. So if you're, like, Black, working, or non-working poor, you know, there's a certain degree of respectability that you're supposed to have about, like, sharing experiences. And in my adult life, I'm, like, right up against that all the time because I'm in a graduate program, which is, like, that's only respectability politics. But I think I ultimately was, like, if there's a reader who is going to believe that these experiences represent like every Black person or every whatever, I'm like, that person is already lost to me. That person's already too far gone to me. And I was kind of like, at that point, it's fine. You know, I can accept like not having that reader along. And I was also, you know, for my own thinking, my own experience, if some people thought I was still being too mild, and things people who, you know, in my own family or people who I grew up with thought I was being too mild, then that meant to me that I was like, okay, I'm striking some kind of balance. If there are people who are like, you are being really tame and, you know, underselling certain things that happen, I was like, okay.
Yeah. I mean, so one of the things that came to me in reading your book, which is what I appreciated most about it, but also made me think a lot about books in general, and more specifically books by Black people, and especially books that are coming out now after the summer of 2020, when the discovery of Black Americans by white Americans in America in 2020. There was so much of this, like, we don't want to see Black trauma, and like, we don't want to see Black pain, and we don't want to read slavery stories, and like, we want to celebrate Black people. And obviously that's a pushback to what has been presented as Black people in the media. It's a pushback to, you know, the Oscar winning performances by drug addict mothers and incarcerated men in these things. So I understand where that impulse comes from. But reading your book is one of the first books I've read since that's come out like since 2020, not in the immediate aftermath, but, you know, had time to be published in 2020, where I felt like we're talking about the things that happen in the Black working and non-working poor communities that had sort of been shunned for a little bit because it was like, oh, this is too dark or too stereotypical or too whatever. So I'm wondering sort of, there's not a specific question, but the question in there is sort of like, what was that like for you maybe pitching this book, talking about this book in the publishing space, trying to get it published? What were there conversations about that? Were you having conversations about not wanting to write this story in a certain way, or like any of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Tracy. I at first, I did think about that a lot. And I wasn't, this isn't the first book that I had written. I mean, I had written a collection of short stories. I had written like a fantasy novel. Then I had written most of this other novel that didn't get out there. And it felt honestly like I was circling around these questions and not being honest with myself or what kinds of stories I wanted to see and or read. And it ended up feeling like when I would try and pitch these other stories or what have you, they just felt flat. And that was the response of when I, you know, submission wouldn't work for a certain set of things, or I would be talking to people who I trusted, who I exchanged writing with, and would be like, oh, there's like something missing here. Or like, you are, you know, hiding from this particular set of problems that you really mm-hmm. want to talk about mm-hmm. by like supplanting it in this, like, you know, 30-year-old protagonist who has a completely different set of, you know, life considerations, et cetera. And so, you know, I eventually had to just start trying to be more honest with myself about what I thought was important there. And I also am kind of like, I started to feel the way that, you know, people are like, we shouldn't talk to each other about our salaries in whatever world or whatever job. I was like, who is that helpful for ultimately, right? I'm like, I don't think that, I just didn't think that not talking about painful experiences was helpful. And there's also, you know, a kind of tradition of going back and forth on that problem, I think, in thinking about like, you know, African-American literature in general, right? And so I am kind of like, it's not only pain, you know, it's not only joy. These are just a kind of set of experiences that can sometimes but not always be generalizable. And it was more valuable to me to be kind of straightforward as I could about that. Particularly if I'm thinking about the way we discuss children or the way we, the 2020 discovery of like Black people is kind of always as like either already dead or as like aftermath. Mm-hmm. And the kind of conversations about those stories too are not usually about the person's life or experiences. And sometimes we say a lot of things in the name of a set of individuals that don't have that much to do with them, but about their kind of status as symbols or props or whatever. And I'm like, I don't think that that's the same as having really difficult conversations about our actual lived experiences. And for me, there's a disconnect between those two things.
Right. And for me, as the reader of your story, I was like, I'm glad this book exists because your life happened. Your life is happening. Like it's like, I sort of understand that impulse a little bit if it's like fiction, maybe, but I'm like, I don't know. I don't want great writers to feel like they can't tell their stories because it is deemed stereotypical. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, well, you happen. Like, little Joey, this is Joey's story. Like, fuck you for trying to tell me that my story now isn't writable, when if you had written this book in 2018, you know, like, so that, I don't know, that kept like propping into my head as I was reading this book, because it is sort of the first one that I've read where I've been like, oh, this is the thing that we haven't seen as much of because people decided that they wanted to tell Black people how they could have grown up or whatever.
There's a program that we have to follow.
To be Black Boy Joy. If it's not Black Boy Joy, we're not doing it. Even though you still are a Black person who grew up in America before we were discovered as having experienced racism. Yeah. So you experienced all of the things previously. It's just, anyways. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, ultimately, it starts to feel kind of goofy, you know? I will say that, like, pushback and shame stuff has primarily come from, like, middle and upper middle class folks who were like, don't say that. You can't say that.
Black folks or white folks?
Of all, like, black and white folks. And then the people who have been like, you're being more gentle than you should be. You're not being as honest about how brutal things have been or could be. We're all people that I like grew up with or who are from the same neighborhood as me, et cetera. So I think there's something to be said there that things are interesting in that sense.
Yeah, the way the respectability politics sort of are playing out by class, along class lines, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, what is allowed to be said and by whom and under what circumstances.
Right. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for more than 3 years, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. At 52 iterations of their formula and counting, their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and aim to find the best quality ingredients available. Look, there's a reason I keep AG1 in my own morning routine. That's quality. For AG1, it isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because it's NSF certified for sport, one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by making it so there aren't a million different pills and capsules for me to keep track of. It's just one scoop of AG1 mixed in water every day. It could not be simpler. AG1's ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes folate, magnesium, and ashwagandha for stress support. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely looked forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out. Okay, microdosing. Have you tried it yet? I know a lot of folks swear by it. You should know that all sorts of people are microdosing to feel healthier and perform better. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. Whether you're a creative or you're super active, microdosing is for all walks of life. And that goes for people who are curious or longtime fans. These gummies get you right in that sweet spot where you're totally at peace after a workout or a shower or deep in the zone of a project. They're amazing for long hikes or just decompressing with a book under the covers, and they taste as good as they feel. Plus, if you're struggling at all with sleep or joint pain, they'll help with that too. Just take a gummy 1 hour before you want to fall asleep. We're all looking for ways to stay centered and in the moment, but keep our sharpness while in the creative flow or tackling day-to-day work. Microdose gummies are a great way to get that perfectly balanced effect. Even a quarter or half a gummy can go a long way. Get 30% off your first order plus free shipping today at microdose.com, promo code THESTACKS. It's available nationwide. That's microdose.com, promo code THESTACKS for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code THESTACKS.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, we're back. I wanted to just touch on something that you mentioned right before the break and earlier in the conversation was about this shame, this stuff that you were sort of taught was shameful or that you were taught to feel shame around about your experiences growing up. How did you come to terms with some of that stuff in a way that you could write a book that's so open and honest? I mean, you're talking about sexual encounters. You're talking about, you know, having accidents at school. Like, you're talking about the things that are like some of the most shameful things that we're taught as kids. Like, how did you get to a place as an adult where you felt like, okay, I can actually write this and put my name on it and tell people it's nonfiction and this is my story?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess I should say, like, I'm not always completely over everything. You know, everything gets shameful, right? There are ways I think that I can still feel shame, right? I'm not completely like, I haven't superseded that thing altogether. But I think part of it is that one of the things that happens when you become older, you start to realize that these are much more common experiences than we are, that we are allowed to recognize. And part of that is because everybody has been told that you can't say that. And so nobody's really saying it, even though it happened to like dozens and dozens of people over and over again. And this is especially true. So like now that I have my own kids and like I'll be going to like, you know, some school trip or something like that or whatever, and there will be kids in there. I'm like, oh, this is that kid. Like this kid is having the experience or has had the experience that I'm like attempting to describe or something, but will probably never say that thing or right. Or will probably never feel comfortable enough to say that thing in particular. And I also think, you know, shame has a lot to do with people teaching you, right? Like you said, teaching you that the thing is shameful. So it's also interesting to see other sets of kids who are like, have all kinds of accidents or like sexual experience and feel completely open about being like, I made this mistake, or I, you know, I feel this way that that otherwise one might feel completely ashamed of, whether that is sexual desire for a whole host of people or experiences or whatever. And I'm like, damn, you know, like, how does it help if I never make statements about, you know, the inverse of that, or show the change from one form of thinking to another? It's like a show your work kind of thing. I don't like to pretend. Sometimes I hear, you know, I get in conversations with people and everybody be like, look at how far we've come kind of thing. Right. Like things are great now. And I'm like, well, for one, things aren't great for most of the people I know. Like their lives have gotten worse in a lot of ways. And I don't like to skip over the fact that that it was very costly to learn a lot of things, to get from one point to another. And so I thought it was worth it, you know, to say these things. And I talk pretty openly to my own kids. The oldest of two are 12 and 10. And sometimes they ask me stuff and I will just be completely honest with them. And that has helped opening up those conversations.
I think in some of the situations, at least for me as a reader, it felt like you were very clearly, you know, the victim of bullying or adults, you know, taking things out on you. And to me, I'm like, there's no shame in that, you know, in my thinking. But then there's also parts of the book where you sort of let us in to maybe how you were thinking about it in the moment, and also maybe how you think about it now as an adult. There's one part that comes to mind where you talk about how human survival is predicated on other people getting hurt for other people to feel good and feel alive. How have you been grappling? I mean, it feels so on the nose, first of all, especially in a country like America the American dream is allegedly, you know, this heart and center of America. But to me, what I think about as a heart and center of America is, are you high enough on the American food chain that you don't have to worry about being the one who gets hurt for other people to feel good and alive? And that feels just like so American. So how do you grapple with that trade-off? Because there are parts of the book where you don't get hit and Gani does. And there's parts of the book where you aren't getting picked on and another kid is. And obviously you've been, you know, you're tormented by some of the other kids in your school. And so, of course, you're like feeling the sense of relief. But now as you look back as an adult, like how does that play into some of the shame? Because there's shame in feeling like you weren't the brave person to stick up for someone else. But there's also like this thing of like, hey, I just shit my pants at school because kids were fucking with me. Like, I'm not going to feel bad about someone else getting fucked with because I don't have to shit my pants today and go home and get yelled at. Like, so I totally get it. But there is this dichotomy of like, how can you be a good person and a safe, alive person who's not getting fucked with?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel like that is really on the nose, Tracy. It's useful to think about because I guess I try to be as thoughtful as possible about the space that you're in and how difficult it is to maybe. I think that when people tell me that they're a good person via, like, I don't know, direct or indirect kinds of virtue signaling as like the main form of communication, I get really suspicious of those people sometimes. And I'm like, well, given the kind of circumstances that we are in, particularly in a country like America, right? It's like very unlikely that one is innocent. Mm-hmm. Though we are really obsessed with the idea that we are innocent. Mm-hmm. And we use that a lot in conversations, especially like to cudgel people, you know, for like being bad or whatever. And I just think that I was trying to think about the earliest times in my life when I started to understand that. And for me, that had to do with like school. It mostly had to do with school. And I started to think like, okay, well, is it that? And also we use innocence as like the ledger to be like, we can treat someone nicely if they're innocent. Like,
right.
This, you know, this black person was murdered. How innocent are they to you know, to describe what the fuck we're supposed to be able to, you know, it's like all kind of ridiculous, yes. Right?
Oh my gosh. It makes me so mad.
Yeah. It makes me so fucking mad.
So mad.
And, you know, and I think I want to be like, okay, well, the innocence thing has nothing to do with it, right? Like, mm-hmm. we need to establish norms for treating people well that don't have anything to do with that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that starts for me, or that started for me in childhood. And the way I did feel really bad, sometimes I felt more bad by watching somebody else get fucked up than I did when I was getting fucked up. But I was also like, you know, in no uncertain terms, like a complete coward in that setting.
Sure.
And I think that my cowardice was one of the things that stopped me from doing other things, right? That would we would consider like stereotypical Black, right? Like I never sold drugs. I never like murdered anyone as a youth, even though I knew kids who did, right? But I was too afraid to do that. Yeah. And so that doesn't make me like a good person or like better than some of my friends who did, right? But I hate that it's framed that way, you know? And I wanted to go back and forth on that and be like, yeah, you're not superior because like you were a nerd and you got beat up in school instead of beating people up, right? It's just like you're in a situation where there is someone who felt bad by your treatment, you know, whether that was like my little sister or like another friend or something, you know. It's like it doesn't separate you from the situation or the environment.
Right. We're all just like one friend group away from certain behavior,
essentially. A little bit away from,
yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess in the school context, it's like one friend. Yeah. And like, you know, I was a real asshole in school. I was sort of a mean girl. I think it's just I'll defend myself in saying this. Mm-hmm. I never use violence because I'm terrified of all forms of violence, but I am funny. And so I would make a joke about someone else's expense being like, this is hilarious, but it was mean. And I just didn't understand that not everyone, you know, but it's like, now I think about it a little more. I'm still sort of mean spirited. It's my sense of humor, I guess, but it is.
Do you mean in high school or like middle school? Like
Middle school.
Okay.
Well, I was still funny mean in high school, I think, but I think people caught up to I had an older brother who's really smart. And so, you know, okay. It's like you're just around people, like a certain sense of humor, the sarcasm. And like, mm-hmm. I don't know if sarcasm plays super well with like 9, 10, 11 year olds. But when I got to high school, I was like, okay, I feel like I'm better. But the point being is like, I still think that I'm like, probably a good person, but there's definitely people who don't think that about me.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who are 1,000% correct to not think that about me. Like, my big fear is that I would become very famous and then all these people would come out and remember horrible things that I said about them that, like, I can never defend.
Yeah.
You know? And, like, I don't remember them now, but, like, I'm sure I was mean. You know?
And there are certainly, right? And I don't mean to, like, you know, relativize it to the extent where I'm like, oh, there's no difference in, like, what kinds of meanness or what kinds of violence or whatever, you know?
No, of course not.
I would never want to do that because I think sometimes people get,
of course.
You know, get upset. Yeah. Like, oh, I'm innocent because I didn't do this thing. And I'm like, well, you know.
Well, right. It's just levels to it. And it's, like, the impact, you know, all of that stuff. Obviously, I wasn't physically violent to anyone. Not that that's any better necessarily, but that's more just a personal thing. Cause like you, I also am a coward and I'm very scared of getting hit myself. And so I would never,
oh my God, it's
for
the
selfish reasons. It's more of a selfish thing. It's like, I don't want to get in a fist fight with anyone because I really don't want to be touched in any way by anyone else. So I'm just going to be cutting and be a psychotic bitch behind your back. You know, just more that vibe.
Well, that's offensive. It's useful. It's useful. You learn, I think, like as you get older and you don't want to fight a lot, you learn to talk shit so that you'd never have to get to that point. So.
That's exactly right. Yeah. It was my defense mechanism. Speaking of defense mechanisms, you have this great section in the book where you talk about thwarting other people's desires by not reacting how people want you to react. So like not crying when the bullies are mean to you or even with your grandfather, you talk about like him wanting you to do certain things and you like remaining really stoic or whatever. Does this still motivate you? Is that still something that you use where you're like, this is what people want from me?
Sometimes. Yeah. Yeah. If somebody says something really fucking ridiculous to me, I'll just be like, I'm not going to say anything to that. That's not worth my engagement. And so there are ways that I still do that sometimes, you know, to a lesser degree, right? You don't have to deal with that as much as a grown person.
Right, right. But was any of that present in the book? Like, did you have any of that where you felt like you were kind of like subverting what you thought people might want from you in the book?
That's a good question. I don't know. I guess what you asked the question about audience earlier too, Tracy. Yeah. And I think my primary audience were like friends who I had known for like, you know, 15, 20-ish years at least. And so they already kind of knew everything. And I was not trying to like subvert their expectations, but there were ways in which, right, of course, like I have over my shoulder a bunch of, you know, people who maybe like I went to work, had like a workshop beef with or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know,
we love a workshop general, beef.
Just like generalize, like, oh, I don't care if this, you know, of engaging with this person who maybe I must have, right? Even if I don't think of it deliberately, like I must have been thinking like, I am not going to do that because you want me to say that mm-hmm. thing. And maybe it's the essay thing. Maybe it's the essayistic part of it. The explaining kind of over, mm-hmm. like going on for pages and pages to be like, well, in this year, did you know, being a sociologist, basically, right? About my own life.
That's so interesting. I get that vibe from you though, that you're a little bit of like a fuck you, I'm not going to do what you think I'm going to do kind of person, which I like. It's a good thing. I like it. I don't, you know, predictability is boring to me. And yeah. I felt like part of that was in your book of like, I'm not going to do this memoir the way that everyone else is going to do this memoir because I don't want you to think that you know what this story is, which I think kept me going because I was like, I actually don't know where this is going. You know, I was like, I actually do want to know what comes next. So towards, I think it's on page 90 because I have notes. and you talk about how like, what's the future gonna be? Will he develop gumption and introspection? Mm-hmm. And will he articulate a nuanced critique of structural injustices centering on the violence of cis white heteropatriarchy and publish said study through a professional press, therefore saving not only himself, but the world from such dangers? And I mean, you're talking about your future you, but also like this book exists now and you did publish this story. And you did, you know, in a sense, get out, if you will, or, you know, not necessarily physically get out, but like you did change the perceived arc of your life and you did make it and all of these things. And then you wrote it and then it's published and it's not just published by anybody. It's published by a Big Five publisher. And so what does that all mean to you? What is that reckoning like for you?
Yeah, it's very, very strange, Tracy. I will say, so there's like a couple of things. I mean, I will say that I'm still dealing with a lot of the costs of that. And I think, you know, attempting to change one's own and like entire family's like class position is just like an ongoing and forever thing, right? So even if I, you know, can, you know, have like a reasonable set of means, like a big thing, I can choose almost like what school my kids go to, right? Like I can move so that I can be like, and this is something I was just dealing with recently, I can move to a place where I can be like, okay, this is a slightly better school. And that was never an option for people in my family for the past like 3-4 generations. And so I'm like, okay, that's different, but it does still feel like a lot of changes that I'm still making that are still necessary. And I also, you know, I think there's something in there about a frustration that I often have where like Black children are used as examples to like lead, like to kind of guide our way into a certain kind of future, not by way of like us paying attention to what they think and feel, but by way of like, here, you take it, you know, like the ball's in your court kind of thing. As in like, you know, you could do the work in a lot of ways. And I felt in my own family, that was one of the kind of overarching things that I felt a lot, which was like, oh, you'll be able to do it. You know, it's like 5 adults or like people older than me. And a lot of folks would be like, yeah, it's on you now. It's like your responsibility. Right. And that, you know, of course that happens a lot in like the larger world as well. And that was such a frustration for me, maybe. And something that sometimes I'm still bitter at, especially when I see people talk about my own kids in that way, or like look to them to be like, oh yeah, you can do this thing or whatever, that maybe doesn't have to do with what they want or need, because nobody's usually asking. The kind of person who does that isn't usually asking, but they're like, oh, you're a future leader of like this kind of thing that we think is good or useful, rather than having a care about, you know, like, do you want to talk about your own desires, your own wishes, your own kind of way that you perceive the world, right? I guess. And I think that in very subtle ways that just happens enough that it frustrates me to no end.
Yeah. Sort of like a mix of uplift suasion and respectability politics, and then also like projecting.
Yeah, it is. When, you know, I think if we spent more time, if we dwelled, you know, with what a lot of like young Black kids you know, felt or desired, we would get a lot of strange and interesting ideas or things would, you know, would be made possible. But sometimes I feel like we're rushing a certain kind of like, you need to grow up and like lead the race or whatever,
right.
You know, in ways that we think are useful. But I'm like, I don't know how useful that is to a lot of these kids in particular. So becomes true. This person probably heard me talking.
Did you know you wanted to be a writer from a young age? Was that something that you knew?
No, not at all. I thought I was going to be like a junior biologist or something like that. Okay. You know, like one of these like Black Steve Irwin kind of people.
Okay.
So I had this, I mean, in the book, you know, there's like,
yeah, there's lots of creatures
obsession.
In the book.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's an animal obsession. And then I thought, you know, in relation to that, I would maybe be a cartoonist. I drew a lot in the ways, but I never really wrote, right? It was, you know, either drawing or thinking that I was like a baby animal behaviorist or something like that.
Writing come in?
I was in school for biology because that's what I used to do. And this is like a, you know, college teacher story that I think is a kind of thing that happens. And I had a couple teachers in college, none probably more important than Aisha Lockridge. She was at St. Joe's. And I would be studying biology, but I would take like African-American lit or writing classes or what have you. And she was like, oh, I think this is like really interesting. Like maybe, you know, you care a lot about this in a way that you don't necessarily care about the biology thing. You just are afraid of being poor for the rest of your life. But, you know, enter this conversation about like, if you get a PhD, they will give you money for this. And you can maybe, you know, simultaneously start providing for yourself and your family while also maybe doing something that you're interested in, right? Or that'll give you a reason to live beyond the immediate or foreseeable future. And so around that time, when I was finishing up studying biology, I decided, I was like, okay, I can go and write now.
Hmm. Speaking of animals, they're on the cover of your book. How involved were you in the cover? And also, will you talk to us a little bit about the title, Sync?
Yeah, so I got really lucky cover-wise. There was like a spate of covers. There was like 5 or 6 of them that my editor sent me. And I immediately was like, okay, this is the one that I like. Mm. And I stuck with that one. And then we like fiddled with it a little bit, you know, changing some textures or what have you, but it wasn't a big shift. So that was, you know, right away, like good reading and labor on Grand Central's kind of. And then for the title, I was thinking of like, so in the second house that we lived in when I was in middle school, there was a lot of like, the sink that was quite literally always clogged. Mm-hmm. And I, like, that was one of my jobs, was to like clean the kitchen. And it would make me so mad because it felt like people were just like throwing shit in there all the time. and they were like, oh yeah, Joey will get it. You know, he'll go get it. And then, but you couldn't really see what was in there either. And so you would put your hand in there and sometimes you get cut by stuff. But yeah, right, exactly. It gives you that kind of.
I hated reading this part. I hated the sink.
I hated it so much. And but it started to stand in for like, I don't know what's in here, but it's like my job, or it's like a certain kind of work that I am tasked with doing and figuring it out. But there's not, from a traditional source at least, a set of like information or programs that is just going to do it for me. Or there's no way to figure out except for like doing it. And you might get cut, you know, like you might pull out, you know, a whole fucking chicken that somebody put in there for whatever reason.
Right.
You know, other kind of goofy things. But it still felt like this was something I had to do. And that became the kind of overarching thinking for the book.
What's not in the book that you wish was?
Maybe more stuff about, like, I would have extended it, I think, maybe, and spent more time talking about or thinking through friendship, which I think is something that I'm writing about a lot now. Mm-hmm. And so maybe when I go back and I look at Sync, I'm like, oh yeah, this is what I'm interested in getting up to, but I kind of like separated it into a whole nother set of programs. Mm-hmm. So I think I would have spent more time focusing on like things that I ended up doing with friends in the kind of later years.
Got it. When you were writing this book, what else were you doing work-wise, school-wise? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was like a lot of stuff. So I was studying biology, and then I was doing the MFA at Notre Dame, but I was working for a long time. I was a medic and I was a EMT. So I was working at this hospital. that was like my main job for like most of my adult life. So I worked at this hospital in North Philly for like 12 or 13 years total. And now I was mostly doing that, but I worked a bunch of, I was working at like Home Depot. I was like working at a bunch of other spots, but it was primarily the hospital all the way up until COVID started. That was around the time that I stopped working at the hospital.
And when you wrote this book, how, or I guess even now still as you write, how often do you write? How many hours a day? Do you write every day? Do you listen to music? Are you snacks, beverages, rituals? Tell me about it.
I mean, I wish I could still write every day. I used to back in the day. Okay. I used to write every day, but I try to write a little bit. I get up super early, like 4:35. The kids are still asleep. You know, my oldest gets up a little bit after that. And then, yeah, it's like 6:15. I'm like, you don't have to be awake right now. Like, why did you go?
What are they doing?
It's like looking at me. I'm like, if you're going to get up at this time, like you could like read stuff or something. Yeah. I know. It was like looking at me. So that's that piece. I tend to just drink like coffee and water when I write. Because if I start eating, it'll be all about the food and I won't do shit else if I start eating. Because I take the food too seriously.
Yeah.
And it'll be, you know, like when I do, I like segment off time to eat. I'm like, this is an important hour and a half where I'm going to eat this thing.
That's a lot of time to eat.
I don't like to rush, you know, it's like I hate. Maybe that's a holdover from like remembering times when I didn't have enough food or something. I'm like, okay,
yeah.
Now I'm going to make sure that I take this eating thing really seriously. We are going to talk about what we're going to eat and we're going to make it, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So that tends to be how it goes. And I get as much reading or writing done as I can before it's time for, you know, school and other stuff to come into play.
And what's a word you can never spell correctly on the first try?
Oh, my God. most words, I think.
Okay.
Staccato, maybe, is a word that I can't spell on the first time. Anything with, like, double vowels or double consonants, I cannot spell on the first try. Nothing.
Consonants are my personal nightmare. It's not happening for me. I know this is sort of a mean question to ask you because when we're talking, your book comes out tomorrow, but do you know what comes next for you?
What's supposed to come next is
next. I'm not like prescribing something has to come next. I'm just curious, like what you're, and you can also say, fuck you. My book comes out tomorrow. I'm not there yet, which is like totally fine.
No, that's fine. So there's a novel that I have revisions due next month, I think.
Oh,
or
okay.
April, something like that. And then a collection of short stories that'll start popping up around sometime with the same editor, same.
It's all Grand Central.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, those are the main things.
For people who love this book, what else would you recommend to them that's maybe in conversation with your work?
I think, everybody who listens to you will have read like Kiese, for example, right?
Yes, of course.
I really like Stephen Dunn's book, Potted Meat, which I felt like was really important for thinking about this book. And I like this other book by Tanya Tagak called Split Tooth, which happened to be one of my favorite books. I think maybe those are two biggies, I guess. Those are two biggies.
When you were writing this, could you read memoir or were you like shutting that genre out as you were working on this? I know that's a really common conversation especially for memoirists. It's like, I won't read any memoirs while I'm working. And some people are like, all I wanted to do was read other memoirs.
I felt like I made reading memoir my job, even though I didn't want to read a bunch of memoirs. I was just like, okay, I can't, you know, write some shit and not read a bunch of the other, and that's my own, like, I don't know, like self-consciousness or whatever. So I was reading them, but I was like frustrated at the fact that I was reading them. And I mostly read stuff that I liked, you know, that I enjoyed during the time.
That you'd read before?
Sometimes that I read before and sometimes new stuff. So, I mean, my favorite genre is still fantasy. And so I was reading a lot of that stuff. And then I'd be like, all right, time for work. I got to read these memoirs now. And it'd be like a stack, you know, that I got to get through.
That's funny. What do you hope folks will keep in mind as they read Sync?
I think I love that thing that you had brought back from Kimon Phoenix saying, thinking about the self as a character. But I really, really would like folks to kind of take seriously experiences of Black childhood that may or may not divulge or shift from what one expects. And that and to think about those years as an experience in and of themselves and not something that needs to be kind of like recuperated into mm-hmm. like adult ways of thinking for like to make the child useful for us.
Yeah. If you could have one person dead or alive read this book, who would you want it to be?
I think now it would be my grandfather, who only just recently passed. He read some stuff, but he hasn't read the whole thing. He read like the, you know, this essay that's in The Offing that was like about him, but not all of it.
Okay. That's it for me, I think. I didn't really talk about any of the nerd stuff, but I don't know. I'm not really into that kind of stuff, so it didn't really stick in my heart. I'm like, I don't know what a Dragon Ball Z is. I've never Dragon Ball Z'd.
Look, if it's not for, you know, and I try not to be overbearing about that stuff. I hate the kind of like nerd evangelist kind of.
Well, I feel like, I will say this. I feel like when the book, you know, I get sent the book, for people who don't know, before a book comes out, you know, they're assigned a publicist and the publicist has a one sheet that they send to media and it says like what the book's about. And this, your one sheet had a lot about like this, like, you know, your childhood and like coming out of it, like because of nerd culture. And as I read it, I just didn't feel like that's what I was reading. Like I felt like you were a nerd, but I don't feel like that transcended your experience at all. I just felt like that was part of your experience. Just like everything else was you know, your relationship with your aunt was and your relationship with your sister and your relationship with your Easy Bake Oven. Like it was all part of it. But I would never be like, oh, this is a book about someone who is saved by food because they loved an Easy Bake Oven. Yeah. So I think like for me, I was expecting this like nerd part to be like this huge part of the book. But it was equally present as were all these other parts. So I think maybe that's why I didn't really like latch onto it, because I didn't know what you're talking about, because Dragon Ball Z, I don't know, I'm not a nerd.
Right.
I'm just a different nerd. I am totally a nerd, just not a video game nerd.
There's different degrees and modes. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. But the way that you described it, that's how I felt about it as well.
Right.
Like all these things are just as important as, you know, like the other things.
Yeah, I think part of it's just marketing. Yeah. But, you know, anyways. But Joseph, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You can get the book now. It's in the world. It's called Sync. Get it wherever you got your books. Do you read the audiobook?
Yes.
Joseph reads the audiobook. So for those of you who love a memoir by author, there you go. And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you again to Joseph Earl Thomas for being our guest. I'd also like to say a thank you to Roxanne Jones for helping to make this conversation possible. Remember, our book club pick for March is Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay, and we will be discussing that book on March 29th with Shanita Hubbard. If you love the show and want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join the Stacks Pack. Please make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.